This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of June 13th. Courts deal Trump a setback on tariffs. President Trump doubled down on his tariff agenda this week and hiked import taxes on steel and aluminum from 25% to 50% after a court found that many of his Liberation Day levies had been imposed illegally. The Court of International Trade, a panel of three federal judges, one a Trump appointee, ruled unanimously last week that the president had exceeded his authority by claiming emergency powers to tax imports from nearly every country. Hours later, a federal judge in a separate case ruled that Trump lacked the power to impose tariffs to reorder the global economy. The trade court decision briefly halted Trump's 30% tariffs on China, 25% tariffs on some goods from Mexico and Canada, and blanket 10% tariffs on most imports, but an appellate court stayed the ruling pending an appeal. Trump assailed the judges as backroom hustlers and called on the Supreme Court to overrule them. His economic advisors said that even if the justices side with the trade court, Trump had other mechanisms for imposing levies. Rest assured, tariffs are not going away, said Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Trump announced his higher tariffs on metals, imposed under a different authority and unaffected by the court rulings, at a rally at U.S. Steel in Pennsylvania. The measures mean nobody's going to be able to steal your industry, the president told cheering steel workers. Trump later griped it was extremely hard to strike a deal with Chinese President Xi Jinping and accused his counterpart of violating a trade truce that lowered triple-digit tariffs while the countries work on a long-term deal. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said the talks were a bit stalled. The trade court's ruling was vital not just for our sputtering economy, but also for the rule of law, said the Wall Street Journal. Trump's use of a 1977 law granting the president emergency powers to deal with any unusual and extraordinary threat was a specious power grab. He cited both the long-running fentanyl crisis and the trade deficit as emergencies, allowing him to seize tariff powers the Constitution grants to Congress. Now the courts have affirmed America doesn't have a king who can rule by decree. It's hard to believe U.S. trade policy could get any more confused and confusing, said Bloomberg, but somehow it has. The paused ruling has only deepened the uncertainty and havoc wrought by Trump's fickle tariff agenda, and trade as usual won't resume until the Supreme Court decides whether the White House can declare non-emergencies to be emergencies. As we await that decision, businesses will avoid making major investments and foreign countries, realizing the justices could suddenly delete Trump's tariffs, will feel little need to strike trade deals. The steel tariffs may give domestic producers a boost, said Scott Horsley at NPR.org. But for every U.S. steel worker, there are about 80 people working for companies that use steel. Many will be stung by higher prices on imported metals with ripple effects hitting the auto, mining, and construction sectors. Analysts say the 25% steel tariffs Trump imposed in his first term cost tens of thousands of downstream manufacturing jobs, and consumers will see price hikes on goods ranging from washing machines to a six-pack of beer. Trump's trade war may have hit a constitutional brick wall, said Gary Winslet in the Washington Post, but it isn't over. Trump now has several options. He could ignore the rulings, triggering an immediate constitutional crisis. He could prevail on Congress to grant him sweeping tariff powers or turn to statutory tools that are more cumbersome than emergency orders but are quite exploitable. There's another choice. Embrace victimhood and lambaste the judges for blocking the greatness he was trying to restore while privately welcoming a rescue from economic chaos. That would be the wise thing to do, said Douglas Schoen and Carly Cooperman in The Hill. Trump's tariffs have inflicted steep damage, whipsawing markets, dimming consumer confidence, and slowing economic growth. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development just downgraded its 2025 U.S. growth forecast to 1.6% from the 2.2% it projected in March, citing the impact of tariffs. And polls show Americans don't like the import taxes. 58% say they hurt the economy, and 74% say they boost prices. The president should take this blessing in disguise and shift course. And yet, as happens so often, Trump may prove to be his own worst enemy. It wasn't all bad. Metal scrapper Nathan Barlow knew he had something more than backyard art when he bought 3,000 pounds of tarnished bronze busts from a fellow dealer. The Chalmette, Louisiana business owner contacted artist Kate Garr, who realized the busts were made by the late Bill Ludwig, creator of New Orleans's statue of Ignatius Riley, the protagonist of A Confederacy of Dunces. Garr cleaned the sculptures and organized a show. My business is destroying things, Barlow said, but Ludwig's was creating. Faizan Zaki, 13, won this year's 2025 Scripps National Spelling Bee, a victory he savored after coming in second last year in a lightning round spell-off. Faizan first made the National Bee when he was 7. He was considered the favorite last year, but lost in a tiebreaker in which competitors try to spell as many words as possible correctly in 90 seconds. The 7th grader studied specifically for the spell-off this year, but won without a tiebreaker. After a near miss in which Faizan flubbed a word late in the contest, he won by correctly spelling éclaircissement, meaning the clearing up of something obscure. He walked away with a cash prize of $52,500 and bragging rights. I decided to have fun with this bee, Faizan said, and I did well. Luke Melling, a 31-year-old Australian, flew to the UK last month to thank the man who saved his life. Alastair Hawken signed up for the British Stem Cell Donor Registry 17 years ago. In 2022, the 51-year-old learned he matched with Melling, then battling Hodgkin's lymphoma. Melling couldn't find any matches in Australia's registry and searched abroad, where he found Hawken, whose stem cells were frozen and mailed to Melling, who returned to full health. Meeting Luke really brings home the difference a simple act can make, Hawken said. Ukraine's shock drone blitz rewrites rules of war. Ukrainian drones rained down on Russian planes parked at airfields deep inside Russian territory this week, destroying or damaging a third of the country's nuclear-capable bombers in a stunning humiliation for Moscow. In a covert op, 18 months in the planning, 117 drones in wooden containers were loaded onto commercial trucks and ferried across the border. Once they reached spots within range of 5 Russian air bases, including one above the Arctic Circle and one far east in Siberia, Ukrainian agents opened the lids of the containers all at once via remote control, allowing the drones to fly out and hit the Russian bombers as they sat parked. Ukraine said 41 planes were hit, causing $7 billion in damage. Video taken by the drones and by gobsmacked Russian bystanders showed huge plumes of smoke over Russian bases. As Russia reeled from the attack, Ukrainian forces used explosives planted on the seabed to bomb the Kerch Bridge, which connects Russia with the occupied Crimean Peninsula. The crucial supply artery had to close briefly. President Trump said he held a phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin lasting an hour and 15 minutes. President Putin did say, and very strongly, that he will have to respond to the drone attack, Trump said. It was not a conversation that will lead to immediate peace. Cue the Star Wars theme music, said Mark Toth and Jonathan Sweet in The Hill. Ukraine's epic, unforeseen drone attack shocked Russia and the world and changed the momentum of the three-year war. Some of the Tu-95 strategic bombers it took out were the same type that had launched missiles at Ukrainian cities just days earlier, and Russia doesn't make those anymore. Ukraine showed that its own reach is now just as deep as Putin's ballistic missiles. Operation Spiderweb will be ranked among the great raiding parties of military history, said The Economist. Ukraine managed to get unwitting Russian drivers to transport drones thousands of miles inside Russia and use AI to find their targets. Russians are likening the moment to Pearl Harbor. This reveals a vulnerability in not just Russia's military, but every military, said Max Boot in the Washington Post, one that should give every general in the world sleepless nights. Drones costing $1,200 a pop can apparently be sneaked past militarized borders and used to take out a chunk of a multi-billion dollar air force. What would prevent the Chinese from doing the same at U.S. air bases, where our planes are clearly visible on satellite imagery? In fact, Chinese interests have for years been buying large amounts of farmland right next to important U.S. military bases, said Phillips, Pace, and O'Brien in The Atlantic. Those strategic spots could be used as staging grounds for drone swarms that would make the Ukrainian attacks look minuscule. The Pentagon clearly has some rethinking to do. In the meantime, Ukraine has proved that whether the U.S. backs it or not, it still has cards to play. Boulder attack adds to anti-Semitic wave. A man accused of yelling "Free Palestine" as he threw Molotov cocktails at a Boulder, Colorado demonstration in support of Israeli hostages was charged this week with a federal hate crime and 16 counts of attempted murder, the latest in a string of anti-Semitic attacks across the U.S. Police said the suspect, U.S.-born Mohammed Sabri Soleiman, told them that he wanted to kill all Zionist people. Soleiman, 45, allegedly planned the attack for a year, waiting until his daughter graduated from high school to act. 15 people, including an 88-year-old Holocaust survivor, were injured in the attack, which took place at a weekly event called Run for Their Lives, intended to keep attention on Israeli hostages taken by Hamas on October 7, 2023. Two victims had to be airlifted to a hospital because of the severity of their burns. Following the attack, Immigration and Customs Enforcement detained Soleiman's wife and five children and revoked their visas. Soleiman entered the U.S. in 2022 on a tourist visa, then applied for asylum. The asylum case was still pending at the time of the attack. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the agency was investigating what the family knew about the attacks. Police said Soleiman had learned to shoot a gun but was unable to buy one because of his immigration status and decided to use Molotov cocktails instead. While FBI and police officials have said the family is cooperating with the investigation, a Homeland Security official said that they will be processed for expedited removal from the U.S. Soleiman is an example of how the U.S. is importing terrorism and anti-Semitism, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. The Boulder attack shows serious vetting of immigrants is necessary, and after their arrival, there must be continued monitoring of their conduct. For most of this country's history, those were regarded as common sense standards that were supported by both political parties. Attacks against Jews in the name of liberation are normalizing terror in our own culture, said Jeffrey Herf in the Free Press. The Boulder firebombing took place less than 2 weeks after a man killed two Israeli embassy staffers in Washington, and in April, an arsonist set fire to the Pennsylvania mansion of Governor Josh Shapiro, who is Jewish. All appear to have been committed by suspects who said they were motivated by support for Palestinians. If denunciation of terrorism and anti-Semitism doesn't grow much louder, an ideology of promoting violence against Jews in order to free Palestine will gain momentum. Some of their condemnation must come from the pro-Palestinian movement, said Daoud Kutab in the New Republic. Much of the world is rightly outraged by the daily killings and starvation inflicted by Israel on Palestinians in Gaza, but supporting unjustified violence elsewhere gives up the moral high ground. Justice for Palestinians must be rooted in law, diplomacy, and human rights, not retribution. Only in America. A West Virginia prosecutor is warning that pregnant women who miscarry may face criminal charges. Women who have abortions can be prosecuted under the state's anti-abortion law, but Raleigh County prosecutor Tom Truman says some state attorneys are considering using human remains statutes to charge women suspected of self-aborting. Women who miscarry, said Truman, should promptly call 911 and just say, "I miscarried, I want you to know." It was a good week for visual learners after reports that Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard is considering reformatting the president's daily intelligence briefing to make him pay attention, potentially as a Fox News-style broadcast delivered by professional news anchors. The problem with Trump is that he doesn't read, an insider explained to NBC. It was a good week for fatalism after a constituent warned Iowa Senator Joni Ernst at a town hall that people are going to die as a result of the Medicaid cuts in President Trump's Big Beautiful Bill, leading the Republican to reply, "Well, we're all going to die." Ernst later noted that eternal and everlasting life does await those who embrace my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. It was a good week for parenting after ultra runner Stephanie Case won a 100-kilometer race over mountains in Wales, despite stopping three times to breastfeed her six-month-old daughter. "Well, that was a surprise," Case said of her win. It was a bad week for eager beavers after Turkish authorities announced new fines for air passengers who leave their seats before the plane has stopped taxiing, or who crowd the aisles waiting to deplane with no thought for the disembarkation priority of the passengers in front of or around you. It was a bad week for deep research after Harvard University stripped tenure from behavioral scientist Francesca Gino, who was found to have falsified data in a number of her studies, including three on human dishonesty. The now former professor Gino denies the allegations. It was a bad week for renewables after Dutch meteorologist Remco Verzilberg, in an interview with Belgian television, accused Belgium of stealing some of our wind. Verzilberg says new Belgian wind farms in the North Sea are consuming up to 3% of the wind that would otherwise reach Dutch turbines. Clovis, California. Trans sports. A transgender California athlete last week took three medals at what some consider the nation's most competitive state track and field meet, reigniting a heated national debate about trans girls competing in girls' sports. 16-year-old A.B. Hernandez, a high school junior, shared first place in the triple jump and high jump and second place in the long jump at the CIF State Track and Field Championships in Clovis. While Hernandez had the better scores in those events, a last-minute rules change let the athletes who finished with the next best distance share the medal and the podium. President Trump had pressured Hernandez to withdraw, threatening to cut California's federal funding if state officials allowed her to participate. Polls show that while most Americans support transgender rights, they oppose trans girls competing in youth sports. California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom recently called trans girls in girls' sports deeply unfair. Washington, D.C. lie detector. FBI Director Kash Patel is tearing apart his agency from the inside, complete with a series of firings and an expansive use of lie detector tests, the New York Times reported this week. Patel has forced out and demoted agents while placing others on leave. One lawyer was removed from a key human resources job, and multiple top female agents were told to take a different post or retire. The FBI has now lost decades of institutional knowledge. The agency also recently disbanded the corruption squad that investigated President Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election. Meanwhile, Patel is making agents take polygraph tests to crack down on media leaks. Polygraphs aren't admissible in court, but the FBI uses them in criminal investigations. Former officials reported Patel polygraphing senior officials at a rapid rate, saying his actions represented a dramatic escalation. "I never used them to suss out gossip," said former agent Jim Stern, who conducted hundreds of polygraphs. Flin Flon, Manitoba, wildfire evacuations. Wildfires forced tens of thousands of Canadians to flee their homes last week and sent thick smoke wafting deep into the U.S. Midwest across the Dakotas, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Provincial authorities in the border provinces of Manitoba and Saskatchewan declared states of emergency, and Manitoba's evacuation of 17,000 residents was the largest displacement the province has seen in decades. Over 4,000 square miles have burned across Canada already this year, more than double the usual amount at this point in the fire season. El Saida Alerta of Flin Flon, Manitoba, said residents could barely breathe when the evacuation order came. "The town is absolutely smoked out," she said. "We're just kind of in a panic here." Paris. Deadly street party. At least two people were killed in Paris last week, one stabbed, one hit by a car, during street celebrations that erupted after soccer team Paris Saint-Germain won its first title in the Europe-wide Champions League. Hundreds of others were injured, and rioters burned more than 200 cars. Fans rushed into the streets, waving PSG flags, setting off fireworks, and blocking traffic just minutes after the team trounced Inter Milan 5-0 in the title match. Groups of soccer hooligans clashed with the thousands of police who were stationed on the Champs-Élysées for crowd control, and about 500 people were arrested. Tehran, centrifuges spinning. Iran's supreme leader said this week he is 100% against any pact requiring Iran to entirely abandon uranium enrichment, saying it needs a homegrown program to fuel nuclear power plants. The rude and arrogant leaders of America repeatedly demand we should not have a nuclear program, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said. They can't do anything about it. Under President Trump, the U.S. pulled out of the Obama-era nuclear deal, and it's been negotiating a new deal with Iran. The UN's watchdog group, the International Atomic Energy Agency, says that during the week of talks, Iran has been furiously enriching uranium to 60% and now has a 900-pound stockpile that could be boosted to weapons grade in 14 days. Nuclear plants use fuel at 3% to 5% enrichment. Rafah, Gaza, killed at aid site. Israeli soldiers opened fire on Palestinian crowds near a food distribution site in southern Gaza twice this week, killing at least 50 people and injuring over 300, Gaza officials said. Gaza has been under a blockade for months, its people near famine, and Israel said recently it would allow limited aid distributed not by the UN, but by a new U.S. and Israeli-run Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. But the GHF opened just two distribution hubs, which were quickly overwhelmed by hungry civilians. "Is this what they call aid?" asked Nawal al-Masri, a Palestinian whose young son was injured at the site. "This aid is to kill people." Israel said its forces had shot at several suspects who strayed from designated access routes and posed a threat. The UN said the mass shootings may constitute a war crime and called for a full investigation. Singapore, warning on China. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth last week warned allies that China posed an imminent threat to Taiwan and said the U.S. would emphasize deterrence. Speaking at the Shangri-La Dialogue Annual Defense Summit in Singapore, Hegseth said Beijing hopes to dominate and control too many parts of Asia and plans to be capable of a 2027 invasion of Taiwan, but he used the word peace 27 times. "President Trump is a leader of peace, a man of peace, a force for peace," Hegseth told defense and military chiefs from Asia and the Pacific. "And together we will achieve that peace through strength." Under the Biden administration, U.S. defense intelligence had played down the 2027 invasion goal, saying recent Chinese purges of generals had weakened military readiness. The Chinese delegation accused Hegseth of making groundless accusations and trying to provoke trouble. How Bates got even. "Kathy Bates' own father didn't think she looked like a movie star," said David Canfield in Vanity Fair. He told her hometown acting teacher that his daughter, who would go on to win an Academy Award for her role in Misery, was not conventionally attractive. Similar comments followed her throughout her five-decade career, Bates says, and when she was younger, they would devastate her. "You're not Michelle Pfeiffer," one journalist informed her. Later, Gary Marshall refused to cast her in Frankie and Johnny, even though she had originated the role on stage to great acclaim, because, she says, "he couldn't make the leap that people would see me on screen kissing someone. The role went to Pfeiffer." On another occasion, a journalist asked Aidan Quinn, Bates's on-screen husband in another film, if it was even believable that the two of them could possibly be married. "I went upstairs, I locked the door, and I cried like a kindergartner. In Hollywood, I never felt that I belonged." She was being cast as the friend, the neighbor next door, the crazy one, the action away from the center of the frame. Now, at 76, she's getting accolades and steady work starring in the CBS hit series Matlock. "It's sweet revenge. Oh, Miss Beauty Queen, you had a career up until your 40s and you can't work? Too bad." Jeopardy's stay-at-home son, Brendan Leah, is unbothered by his lack of a career, said Callum Borchers in the Wall Street Journal. The Jeopardy champion, who has no job and lives with his parents, had host Ken Jennings introduce him on air as a stay-at-home son. "The phrase is tongue-in-cheek," says Leah, 27, "and sounds better than unemployed." But Urban Dictionary, which added the term in 2007, defines it as an unmotivated man-child, and that doesn't quite fit Liao. He has a master's in political science and was studying for the LSAT when he got the call for Jeopardy. Immediately, he began training intensively for the show, memorizing trivia and practicing how to respond quickly under stress. It was about a month of something like a Rocky montage. I practiced with a buzzer, watching 5 episodes a day in a suit standing in my living room. I was doing cardio every day, getting on the stationary bike. It all paid off. When Liao won nearly $60,000 across 3 contests that aired last month, and with all the attention he got, he may put law school on hold while he ponders his options. His advice to others who are in career limbo? Hang in there, maybe study for Jeopardy. Lupone's breakup with Broadway. Patti LuPone was for years the tempestuous queen of Broadway, said Michael Shulman in The New Yorker, as brassy and pushy as New York City. Like a commuter elbowing through Manhattan's rush hour crowds, the 3-time Tony winner and Evita star has always fought her own battles, but that doesn't sit well with some people. On a woman, they don't like that smell, said LuPone, 76. I've been punished for wondering what's going on since I was 4. She has had beefs with everyone from Andrew Lloyd Webber, who fired her from the original London production of Sunset Boulevard, to fellow icon Audra McDonald, who she calls not a friend. At one point, she stopped a play to snatch a cell phone from a texting audience member. Perhaps that's why many in the theater would view her as a diva, a term she dismisses, and why she now says she's leaving the stage altogether. I know that I'm box office. Don't nickel and dime me before you put me on stage. Don't treat me like a piece of shit. Because at this point, if you don't value me, why am I there? For all her bluntness, though, LuPone doesn't enjoy quarreling with her colleagues and fans. What am I learning in this life that I'm atoning for from the last one, she wonders. What is it that forces me to fight? Seriously, why wasn't it easier? A jubilant Taylor Swift last week bought the master recordings for her first 6 albums, ending the pop star's years-long battle for control of her own music. The right to distribute and license those albums, from her 2006 self-titled debut to 2017's Reputation, was acquired by music executive Scooter Braun in 2019 when he snapped up her former recording label. Swift had bad blood with Braun, accusing him of complicity in the incessant manipulative bullying against her by Kanye West, one of his clients. The following year, Braun sold Swift's catalog to private equity firm Shamrock Capital for $300 million, leading Swift to re-record the albums and release them as Taylor's versions, effectively shrinking the value of the master tapes. Shamrock sold the recordings back to Swift, 35, for about $360 million, sources told Billboard. To say this is my greatest dream come true, Swift said, is actually being pretty reserved about it. Cardi B and NFL star Stefon Diggs went public with their romance this week, posting a string of raunchy images on social media. The Bodak Yellow rapper, 32, shared a photo of the pair cozying up on a yacht off Miami, as well as a steamy video in which she twerks on the New England Patriots wide receiver, 31, in a swimsuit. The new relationship has blossomed amid Cardi's ugly divorce proceedings from her estranged husband, the rapper Offset. After Offset, 33, requested spousal support from Cardi, she posted online that he had left her with their three children's bills for a whole year straight and had seen their youngest child, 8-month-old Blossom, only like 5 times. The sex trafficking trial of Sean Diddy Combs this week heard testimony from the rap mogul's ex-assistant, who accused her former boss of repeatedly sexually assaulting her. Using the pseudonym Mia, the woman who worked for Combs from 2009 to 2017 said the Bad Boy Records founder once forced her to perform oral sex as she sat on the floor of his closet to help him pack for a trip, and, on a separate occasion, raped her after climbing into her bed. Combs' lawyers pressed Mia on friendly messages she sent her ex-boss after leaving his employment and questioned why she failed to come forward with her allegations earlier. "Because I was terrified and brainwashed," Mia replied. Trump's extremist brain. Stephen Miller has emerged as an unrivaled power within the White House. What does he want? What is Miller's role? The 39-year-old has 2 titles, Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy and Homeland Security Advisor. But they don't convey the power Miller wields or the extent to which he's said to be shaping Trump's second-term agenda. Long known for his combative style, frenzied work ethic, and fevered devotion to Trump, the anti-immigration crusader is now also seen as a shrewd operator with a talent for pulling the levers of government. Insiders say Miller has built a strong relationship with his often fickle boss because of his ability to channel Trump's impulses, to articulate them in speeches and translate them into policy. "I call Stephen Trump's brain," said former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, citing Trump's complete trust in Miller. Senator Ben Ray Lujan, Democrat of New Mexico, has a blunter take. "As the architect of Trump's ugliest policies," he said, "Miller is responsible for all the bad things happening in the United States." Which policies bear his stamp? Miller helped prepare the dozens of executive orders that Trump signed on returning to the Oval Office in January. They included orders to revoke the birthright citizenship for the children of undocumented immigrants and many visa holders. That order was quickly blocked by the courts. And the declaration of a national emergency at the southern border. Miller reportedly pushed Trump to impose tariffs on Mexico and Canada, and, having developed a distrust of federal workers who he believes stymied Trump's first-term agenda, worked closely with Department of Government Efficiency leader Elon Musk in slashing government agencies. Miller's wife, Katie Miller, was a DOGE advisor until last week. A zealous opponent of what he calls anti-white bigotry and cancerous communist woke culture, he has driven efforts to eradicate diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI programs, and to roll back transgender rights. His obsession, though, is immigration. He has masterminded Trump's efforts to effect mass deportations of undocumented migrants, close legal pathways to citizenship, and use the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to deport alleged gang members. Miller, who vowed Trump's second term would deliver pure bliss for immigration foes, has been preoccupied with the issue since his youth. What sparked that obsession? He grew up in a well-off, Democratic-supporting Jewish family in liberal Santa Monica, California, but said he swung to the right as a teenager after reading Guns, Crime, and Freedom, a 1994 book by Wayne LaPierre, then the CEO of the National Rifle Association. At his public high school, Miller became notorious as a conservative firebrand who relished confrontation. A friend from middle school, Jason Islas, said Miller told him at the start of ninth grade that the pair could no longer associate in part because of Islas's Latino heritage. In the high school paper, Miller complained that Latino students lacked basic English skills, noted the dearth of Latinos in his honors classes, and blasted the school's policy of making bilingual announcements. He became a regular guest on a local conservative talk radio show, appearing dozens of times. Miller kept up the fight at Duke University, where he wrote a biweekly column for the college paper in which he blamed the 9/11 attacks on politically correct domestic security, accused black students of suffering racial paranoia, and attacked professors for being registered Democrats. His writings attracted national attention, and after graduation, Miller headed to Washington, D.C. What did he do there? Miller went to work for former Representative Michelle Bachmann, Republican of Minnesota, an arch-conservative whose many controversies included blaming immigrants for bringing in diseases and violence. Then, in 2009, he became a staffer for hard-right Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions and became known for bombarding fellow GOP aides with mass emails on immigration, sharing links from what one called fringe websites. In 2014, Miller was credited with helping Sessions kill a bipartisan effort at immigration reform. The next year, when Trump announced his candidacy, Miller was riveted by the outsider and his anti-immigrant rhetoric. "It expressed everything that I felt at the deepest level of my heart," he said. He joined the Trump campaign and, after Trump's November 2016 victory, helped write the president's Blood and Soil inauguration speech, which vowed to end American carnage and put America first. Did he play a major role in the administration? Many of Trump's most controversial first-term policies were co-authored by Miller. They included the short-lived ban on travelers from several Muslim-majority nations, the Remain in Mexico policy that prohibited migrants seeking asylum from entering the U.S., and the use of the public health law Title 42 to suspend U.S. entry during the COVID pandemic. Most notoriously, he promoted the family separation policy that took more than 3,000 migrant children from their parents. When images of anguished families appeared on news networks, sparking a public backlash, a White House advisor told Vanity Fair that Miller actually enjoys seeing those pictures, adding, "He's Waffen SS." Having spent years laying the groundwork for a second Trump term, he is now determined to make an even more transformative impact. What are his plans? His broad goals for the next 4 years are to deport all 14 million undocumented migrants in the U.S., turbocharge efforts to strip naturalized Americans of their citizenship, and expand Trump's executive powers. Miller believes he is saving the U.S. from an apocalypse, said Gene Guerrero, who wrote a 2020 Miller biography, Hatemonger. Trump is likely to keep Miller close despite the controversy he generates. The president said last month that he had considered making Miller his national security advisor, a high-profile West Wing role, but that job would be a downgrade from his current position overseeing a swath of policy areas, said Trump. Steven is much higher on the totem pole than that. RFK Jr.'s surrender to bird flu. RFK Jr. may have just ruined our best weapon against bird flu, said Jonathan Cohn of the Bulwark. The kooky health secretary last week canceled a $766 million contract to develop a human vaccine against the virus that's currently ravaging poultry farms and could potentially mutate so that it can easily pass among people. With human mortality rates as high as 50% in previously isolated outbreaks, a bird flu pandemic could dwarf the impact of the COVID pandemic, which killed more than 7 million people. That's why the Biden administration awarded a contract to develop a bird flu vaccine to Moderna, the biotech company that created one of the original COVID vaccines. Moderna's secret sauce is mRNA technology, which allows for much quicker vaccine production than traditional methods. But now Kennedy, who has spread egregious lies about the supposed danger of mRNA vaccines, has killed that effort to develop a bird flu vaccine. A spokesperson called mRNA technology under-tested. That's absurd. The COVID vaccine has been administered to more than 1 billion people and has shown an excellent safety record. Kennedy is imposing his irrational bias against mRNA shots on the public, and it may one day have terrible consequences. Deportations, a crackdown on legal migrants. President Trump wants to put big deportation numbers on the scoreboard, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post, and the Supreme Court just gave him an assist. In a 7-2 emergency ruling last week, the justices cleared the way for the Trump administration to revoke the Biden-era humanitarian parole protections awarded to 530,000 immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, while litigation continues in lower courts. Those people came here legally and with the government's blessing, just like the 350,000 Venezuelans who lost temporary protected status after a similar ruling in May. But Trump is frustrated that he's lagging on his pledge to remove millions of undocumented migrants. About 17,200 people were deported in April, 29% more than a year earlier. And so his administration is trying to deport just about anyone it can conceivably fit into the system. Meeting deportation quotas by hunting down actual criminals is hard, said Catherine Rampell, also in the Post. It's much easier for agents to catch de-documented migrants who voluntarily told the government where they live. It may seem unfair, said Dan McLaughlin in the National Review, but the administration is acting within its powers. The lower court judges who tried to block the White House from rolling back immigrant parole programs treated them as a one-way ratchet in which Trump was not allowed to undo what Biden had done by the same means. The justices have so far found the right balance on immigration, giving the administration a lot of room to maneuver in making general decisions of immigration policy while drawing a red line around the application of laws to individual immigrants and defending their right to due process. Constitutional or not, Americans will be hurt by this mass revocation of visas, said Valentina Palm in the Palm Beach Post. About 80% of the affected humanitarian parole recipients live in Florida, and many work in critical industries facing labor shortages, including healthcare, education, hospitality, and construction. Economic concerns aside, no one should be forced to return to a dictatorship in Venezuela or gang rule in Haiti because of the whim of a particular president, said the Miami Herald in an editorial. This chaotic scenario would never have happened if Congress had done its job years ago and passed meaningful immigration reform. But our leaders failed to step up, and now our neighbors, friends, relatives, and co-workers will pay the price. Rainforests up in smoke. Global forest land hit a record high last year due largely global forest loss hit a record high last year due largely to raging wildfires, the World Resources Institute reports in its latest annual assessment. The planet lost an area of forest land the size of Italy, and a quarter of that was rainforest. Before last year, agriculture had always been the primary culprit in tropical deforestation. In the wet tropics, fire is not a natural part of the ecosystem cycle in the way it is in boreal or conifer forests. But in 2024, fires were the main driver of rainforest loss, emitting 4 times the greenhouse gases produced by all global air travel that year. Amazon rainforests in Brazil were by far the hardest hit, driven by the worst drought since records began, and Amazon forests in Bolivia took second place for the first time. And the Congo Basin, home to the world's second largest rainforest after the Amazon, set its own new record of forest loss. The signal in these data is particularly frightening, study leader Matt Hansen of the University of Maryland tells The Guardian of the UK. Rising global temperatures are making forests hotter and drier, and as a result, more likely to burn. We have a lot of work to do to confront such a widespread, destructive, and increasing fire dynamic. Gene therapy for brains. Scientists have developed a new tool that delivers genes to malfunctioning brain and spinal cells to treat neurodegenerative diseases like ALS and Parkinson's, reports the Washington Post. Over 300 researchers working with the National Institutes of Health Brain Initiative created a system that maps how neural cells work together and how diseases interrupt their pathways. Then they engineered a virus that can act as a delivery truck to drop off a package of genetic material in only the affected cells without damaging surrounding cells. So far, researchers have successfully applied the delivery system to mice, rats, non-human primates, and to human brain tissue in a lab, and it shows great promise. Because it can cross the blood-brain barrier, such a therapy could theoretically be given via intravenous infusion without the necessity of risky brain surgery. This will revolutionize both our grasp of how the brain works and our ability to treat intractable conditions, says Gord Fischel, a Harvard neurobiologist who works with brain. The advances will be nothing short of life-changing. Wild Thing, A Life of Paul Gauguin by Sue Prideaux. Sue Prideaux's gruesomely fascinating Paul Gauguin biography opens with a bit of myth-busting, said Anne Higonnet in the Wall Street Journal. In 2000, 4 of the celebrated painter's teeth were found in a well near his one-time home in French Polynesia, and later, testing of the teeth indicated that he had probably never contracted syphilis. This twist surprises, as we've long been told that the Paris-born post-impressionist was a sex tourist who died of the sexually transmitted disease after spending the last dozen of his 54 years spreading it among the teenage girls he impregnated in French Polynesia. Prideaux acknowledges that Gauguin had left his wife and children to move to pursue his art in Tahiti, but maybe he was professionally selfish in a relatively ordinary way. His late work is evidence that the accomplishments of the selfish are real. When Prideaux defends Gauguin's relationship with women, it can feel as if she is overcompensating, said Nadia Beard in the Financial Times. Yes, his marriage was happy until an 1882 financial crash cost him his position as a stockbroker, and he encouraged the women in his life to seek fulfillment through independence. But after moving to Tahiti at 43, he took several girls under 16 as sexual partners. Still, presenting us with these contradictions is part of the book's triumph, making them a problem for the reader to resolve. If we want to dismiss Gauguin as a self-centered colonist, we have to contend with the anti-colonial activism for which he was jailed by French authorities. When Prideaux mounts an argument that Gauguin's Tahitian paintings were themselves anti-colonial, your mileage may vary, said Hamilton Kane in the Minnesota Star Tribune. Generally, though, she displays a gift for illustrating the intricacies of an artist's perspective, said Sarah Morehouse in the Los Angeles Review of Books. She's also persuasive in depicting Gauguin as a Frenchman who was forever pursuing a return to the unbound, back-to-nature existence he had known during an early childhood spent in Peru. To experience his paintings is to enter a dream world of his creation in which symbol and feeling matter as much as what the eye sees. He's not an easy artist, yet he's a great one. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.